I don't believe that life is black and white. I don't believe that everything has to go one way or the other. But I do think that people have a tendency to see things that way. When something happens, they have to fit it into the terms of a story. There has to be a beginning, an ending, a good guy, and a bad guy. And I think that when we view things that way, we start to lose sight of the truth about what happened and who these people were. And I don't think that anybody understands this better than David because of his brother Ted.
Well, it might be interesting to start at the beginning, which is talking a little bit about my family. Yeah, I grew up in a family of four people, mom and dad and my older brother, Ted, and me. Ted is 7.5 years older than me. And from the time I was a child, I realized that he was special. Mostly, I think, in a very good way. His IQ was measured at 165 when he was, I think, about 13 years old. And you're thought to be a genius at 140, so Ted was remarkably smart. He graduated from high school 2 years early. He went to Harvard University, ended up getting his PhD at the University of Michigan. By the time he was in his early 20s, he was a professor at one of America's elite colleges, Berkeley, UC Berkeley. Now, there was also some unease that I felt at times about Ted. I never felt the slightest unease in his presence. I mean, he was a good big brother, but he would isolate himself a lot. He'd spend long hours in his room. He had very few friends in school, and I remember asking our mother, what's up with Ted? Why doesn't he have friends, or why does he behave this way? She said that when Ted was a little baby, 9 months old, he had gotten sick, and they had to take him to the hospital. And in those days, families weren't very welcome at hospitals. It was like they saw the little baby as like a little machine that you fix, and they didn't want the parents getting in the way. So they were only allowed to visit 3 times a week for 2 hours. And it seems like at least in mom's perception, Ted really lost something during that period in the hospital. I recall her saying to me once, David, don't ever abandon your brother. He probably doesn't remember the hospital experience, but abandonment is what he fears the most. And of course, at that point, I love my brother. We had such a good relationship. I was very moved by this story, and I said, oh, Mom, of course, I'd never abandon Ted. As Ted grew older and was a teenager, I always get the sense, he didn't need people, or that was the kind of the message or the vibe that came out of my brother. And years later, when he was living in the forest in Montana in this cabin, Mom and Dad started receiving these very, very angry letters from Ted. And the basic gist of those letters was that he's been, unhappy all his life. And now he'd had a lot of time to think about it and try to understand why he was so unhappy. And he told them he felt he was unhappy because they never truly loved him. When Ted was in college, actually, he was terribly stressed. He had volunteered for a psychological experiment of young men at Harvard, and it was an experiment that he was involved in for 3 years, and it was clearly an abusive experiment. It would not pass today's ethical tests for informed consent, respecting the dignity of the. And the experiments involved subjecting young men to stress, having their values, their dignity challenged, and seeing how they would react to that.
And he was only 16 at the time of those tests, wasn't he?
I think he began to undergo that experiment when he was 17. Might have been 16. I know mom remembered having to sign a release because he was not yet 18. And her thought at the time was, well, maybe these nice psychologists will help my son with his, social awkwardness. And of course, the likelihood is that they did him grave damage.
When did he start to endorse the views that he endorses now?
I think he was probably in his early 20s. I don't you know, again, 7.5 years difference. I seem to remember that when I was in high school, so he might have been in his mid-20s, already teaching at Berkeley when he began to talk about, you know, the downside of technology. There was a lot, actually, in the culture about this. You know, the environmental movement was just getting started. Also in terms of his decision to leave his job and go out to Montana and try to live off the land, there was a whole movement back in the 60s and early 70s about, you know, returning to the earth, returning to the land. So in some sense, you know, there was a cultural context for it that made a lot of sense to me. But it seemed like Ted's views had a kind of obsessive quality about them, so that when we would talk, it would be hard for him to, you know, look at it from any different way. It's like he had this one way of looking at it. So I sometimes had concerns that the, you know, there was something overly rigid about the belief system, the ideology.
Do you think maybe he wouldn't have accepted those? Did he need a worldview then? If he was so rigid, I find often that people who are unbending, it's because they need something.
Mm. I told you that I had always thought of Ted as self-sufficient, and I realized later that probably wasn't true. After his arrest, I was invited by his defense team to read his diaries, and he had something like 40,000 pages of writing in his cabin, much of it diaries. And in reading those diaries, it was kind of like opening a window into all of the things that Ted wouldn't talk about or didn't feel comfortable talking about, his feelings, his emotions, his, you know, sometimes men are less willing to open up than women are, but Ted was unusually kind of clamped down. So in reading these diaries, I realized that he really felt desperately, desperately lonely. I think one of the biggest unhappinesses of his life was his inability to connect with a female, to have a girlfriend. I think if somehow he'd been able to make a breakthrough and connect, I think there's a possibility, at least sometimes I think this, that things might have been very different. He might have still had that critique of technology, but maybe he would have, you know, pursued a different methodology of advocacy that was more constructive and less damaging to people.
How hard was it for him to connect to people?
He tried desperately on a number of occasions to reach out to women. And it just never seemed to work. And I'm not sure exactly why. In some sense, you know, Ted seemed to be, you could say, on one hand, he comes across as having a kind of arrogance about him. On another hand, a sense of really low self-esteem. I remember after his arrest, according to his lawyers at least, you know, his picture was in the paper, and especially after he was cleaned up a little bit, and, you know, women would begin to write him and say how handsome he was, and, you know, his kind of comment was, "Now you tell me." I, you know, he never thought he had anything to offer, I think.
If he had been able to connect to someone, do you think he would have turned out the way he did?
Who knows? You know, I can't really fully understand my brother. I've spent my lifetime trying to understand him. It could be that some of the inabilities were, you know, the inability to connect maybe on some level was part of the illness, and maybe, you know, people don't choose to get sick. Whether you could kind of cure illness through human relationship, you'd like to hope you could, but it's possible not. In many cases, like with our family at least, and later on with his legal team, Ted would seem to connect, seem to bond, and then something would happen, and he would cut off. So I guess the question is, had he connected with someone, had he gotten close to someone, would this kind of scenario inevitably come up where he cut off and isolated and turned away? I don't know the answer to that.
So throughout this time, what was your relationship like with your brother?
I always looked up to Ted. I like to tell a story from the time I think I was about 3 years old that really sort of symbolized, I think, the way Ted and I interacted. When I was about 3 years old, our family had moved from an inner city neighborhood in Chicago out to a home in the suburbs. It was our first, you know, home, house to live in, and it was quite a change for me because we had a backyard, and it was a safe neighborhood, and so I was allowed to go out in the backyard and play. And at the age of three, I was very short, but I used to push my way out through this screen door we had in the back and play around and, you know, meet other children and have a ball. And I remember the only frustration that I experienced at that time was that I couldn't enter the house myself. I was so short, I couldn't quite reach the doorknob and the screen door to pull it open and let myself in. And so I remember standing out on the back porch, like knocking on the door, or calling out inside the house, "Mom, Dad, Teddy, come and let me in." And this went on for a while, but I remember one time my brother came out of the house, so he's maybe about 11 years old at this point, but always a very ingenious person. And I saw him fiddling around at the back door, and I walked up there thinking, what's Teddy doing? And what he had done, he had taken a spool of thread from our mother's sewing kit and a hammer and nail from Dad's toolkit in the basement, and he removed the thread from the spool. So he's got this bare spool. He kind of lines it up on the door, puts the nail in the hole in the spool, and he's hammering the spool onto the door. And I'm kind of puzzled, but when he's done, he says, "Dave, see if this works." And all of a sudden, I realized what he'd done. He'd made this little makeshift door handle for his little brother.